Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the front pages. So the Sunday Times is leading with McGregor puts society at risk, warns Taoiseach. They have an interview with Micheál Martin, and he has warned, they say, that Claire Scott and Ian Begley writing this, McGregor's rhetoric on immigration risks discouraging people from coming to work in Ireland. And he says his loose talk, quotes, and quotes, nasty othering of a particular race was fueling division and undermining social cohesion. The Sunday Independent is leading with the story that, and just like that, airport's passenger cap to be scrapped. Niamh Horan has that move set to double numbers at Dublin hub to 60 million a year. So this has been a running sore between all aviation people and the government, Michael O'Leary and Eamon Ryan, and on, it's done. It's going to be done. Business Post is leading with ridiculous, in red, and quotes, developers lash plan to dezone land for thousands of homes, right? So it seems from this that Killian Woods is writing that land earmarked for the construction of up to 3,000 new homes in Wicklow has been dezoned by the local council. He says in defiance of government orders to build more houses, because you will remember we were told over the summer, James Brown told all the local authorities to update their housing targets to be in line with new population targets based on the 2022 census. According to this, and the developers are saying that it is overly restrictive, Wicklow County Council is still going on the 2016 census, they say, and so therefore there isn't, it appears that some land where there were plans to build will now be dezoned until the land that is zoned is built on, at least. Anyway, the Mail on Sunday is leading with Fine Gael presidential candidate Heather Humphreys, John Lee says, was forced to confirm yesterday that her husband was a member of the controversial Orange Order during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. The Mirror is leading with that traitor star Caitlin Deville has been forced to block trolls after being harassed by them online following her stint on the hit RTE show. The Sun on Sunday has Keith Duffy, who they say, furious Keith Duffy, Ken Sweeney is calling him, has slammed on Post for not issuing a boy's own stamp. This comes on the back of Westlife being honoured by the Postal Service to mark their 25-year pop career. Keith fumed, "We paved the way for Westlife. It would have been nice to have been put on a stamp." And the Sunday World has Katie Taylor's husband, we know he visited Ireland with her during the week there. His name is Sean McCavanagh. He's an estate agent who helped her purchase her US home, and he says Katie is the best ever. So, our panel this morning, Pat Leahy is political editor of the Irish Times. Elaine Burke is a science and technology journalist and host of the For Tech's Sake podcast. Scott Lucas is a professor of US and international politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. And Brenda Power is a columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning,
Ben. Scott, I think a lot of Irish people feel we know more about America than a lot of Americans do at this stage and follow the news more closely, but you are the American in the room, so to speak. So I suppose just to lay this out for people first, there have been other cases of political violence in America up to and including murder / assassination in the last few years. Why has the story of Charlie Kirk caught fire to the extent it has? Is it the onlineness of the whole thing?
Well, first, it has to do with Charlie Kirk as a figure, as an activist figure. Having founded as a teenager Turning Point USA years before Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, and I'm sure Elaine can talk more about the technological aspect of this, that he mobilized, used that presence on social media platforms, then eventually with a podcast to get millions of followers, in part, and in the spirit of honesty here, and saying very clearly there is no justification, none whatsoever, for a murder of a man in front of his wife and children. Charlie Kirk's views tapped into the polarizing of America very much. Just very quickly to talk about some of those polarizing views, he believed in replacement theory. Replacement theory, of course, is the unfounded theory that non-whites are being brought in by groups to overtake whites to change American civilization. He opposed, he wanted to retract the Civil Rights Act of 1965. He not only supported that in terms of policy position, but he called blacks unintelligent. He said they were unqualified for positions such as being airline pilots. He opposed women's rights in many cases, saying that they should be in the home subservient to their husband, compared abortion to the Holocaust. And of course, he effectively wanted to erase transgender people while supporting guns, no gun control. Now, none of this is to say that he should have been murdered. But what happened here is three things that then elevate this. First is it feeds into an exploitation by certain people, including the man in the White House, to say that the enemy in America is the left, the radical left. There is no evidence that the suspect in this case who has been detained has left-wing political views. In fact, he actually comes from a pro-Trump family.
Okay. Now, we don't actually know. There are various bits and pieces going around, and I'm not going to get into them here because we don't know at this point what his motivations were. But we also don't know what they weren't. I don't think we can say.
I can lay out certain facts.
I don't want to get into them because I think we'd inevitably get into an interpretation of them that I don't think is responsible at this point.
That's fine. So beyond the fact that there was this attempt to blame the left, and this has continued over the weekend with the idea that this is part of culture wars. What has happened has been that Kirk serves for certain people as a martyr to advance what they want to do. In the United States, that does start with the Trump camp, because the idea, which has been running since he came into office, that they're running against an enemy within, so that you go after the courts. You go after the universities. You go after non-government organizations. You go after those who pursue women's rights and civil rights.
Okay. And just they, move towards a wrap-up. No, did you have a third reason?
Well, secondly, you've got the U.S. dimension on this. And the third of this is actually beyond the U.S. Because another story.
Yeah, and we'll come to the exploitation of the MAGA culture wars in a minute. So, look, Brenda Power, I think you're the person to best answer that. So, like, Scott has laid out there, a lot of Charlie Kirk's unacceptable views. And again, we will look, let's all take for granted so we don't have to continue to repeat it. There was no justification for what happened, right? So his views and the notion of the enemy within. But then there has been very much, it's been pointed out a lot as well, that Charlie Kirk went out and engaged people with these views.
You did, and in fairness, I mean, Scott, you are sort of reflecting a lot of what I saw in left-wing discourse over the last while, which was, well, he did, of course he shouldn't have been shot, but. And I do not think that that is an appropriate response, in fairness.
That's not what I said.
It kind of is. Anyway, no, it's
kind
of.
Hang on. I'm going to intervene there, to be fair. I don't think so. I think we are allowed to have... We are allowed to have compassion and decorum at this moment. We are also allowed to have an honest conversation about who Charlie Kirk was and what he stood for. And that is that is actually central to all this now.
But I mean, I have been astonished by the gloating of the left, and not even the far left, on platforms like Blue Sky and Twitter. I mean, there's one Irish activist said, "I'm having a party to celebrate the murder of Charlie Kirk." I mean, there is no justification, Scott, as you said, none whatsoever, for his legitimately held opinions. You didn't have to agree with them. But he went out there and he engaged with people. And that's what he was doing when he was shot. His catchword was, "Prove me wrong." And he took on everybody, all comers, people who disagreed with him. The majority of those there in Utah, I would say, were of the other, was of a completely different persuasion. But he was prepared to debate with them. So at least he was prepared to put his opinions up for a challenge. And so to say, but they were awful opinions, but he was allowing people to challenge them. I was very struck by a piece in the Sunday Times, Brendan, by Katie Balls, because she's linking, as he himself did actually, the murder of Irina Zarudska, the young woman who was killed on the train in North Carolina by a black man who came up behind her and stabbed her in the neck. And Charlie Kirk, just hours before he was killed himself, said, "America will never be the same." And she says both murders are being taken by the MAGA, movement, no question, as proof of the need for radical change. With Kirk, they lost a free spirit champion. Can I just read this?
Yeah.
Who, as they see it, was slain by the liberals. He was trying to engage in peaceful debate.
Okay.
Sarushka was seen as a victim of liberal criminal justice policies, killed by a man who should never have been released on cashless bail.
How many people are murdered every day in America? This thing that this murder, the murder of Sarushka, did not get the national attention.
But it didn't.
How many people are murdered every day in America, and do we hear of any of them or know their names?
I don't know if you saw the footage, but it was probably the most heartbreaking thing I've seen in a long time. The fact that that girl lay for 2 minutes on the floor of a train station of a train carriage without anybody coming to her aid, bleeding to death. I don't know what that says about American society. I found it more harrowing than the shooting of Charlie Kirk.
Okay, that's fine. But again, I would say to you that is one murder. Scott, I'll bring in the other two in a minute. Scott, do you want to come back on what Brenda said?
Yeah, I think there's two salient points. I think the first is a sweeping idea that there's widespread gloating. There's a 3/4-page article on Charlie Kirk, on his wife, Erica, on other activists, including a far-right activist, Jack Posobiec, which talks about Charlie, and that's fair enough. But it says there's all this extensive left-wing gloating. There's not a single incident, a person named in that article about left-wing gloating. I can tell you that the Oxford Union president-elect said something that was extremely inappropriate, is being disciplined for it. Beyond that, the large majority of people, whether they're left, right, center, or whatever, are not gloating over Charlie Kirk's death. Secondly, the reason why we're not gloating in particular is because not only do you have a man who was killed in a political culture which is quite violent, but there's an evasion of the issues that are taking place. So when they say, for example, that Charlie debated people, that's the point, that he debated people to try to win. He didn't engage to discuss with people. Just before Charlie was killed.
I wouldn't agree with that.
I'll give you the example. Just before Charlie was killed, you may remember the answer is that he was asked about gun violence, including the proliferation of guns in the United States. And he was asked in particular, why are you linking this to transgender people? And Charlie said falsely that many of the gun mass shootings in the U.S. are by transgender
people. I think specifically what he was asked was, how many school shootings have been linked to transgender people? He said too many. The person came back to him and said, well, how many school shootings have there been in America in all? Okay. Elaine, you're the most online person here. So you swim in the water, I think, more than probably the age group of the rest of us. What are your observations over what you've been observing over the last few days?
I'm kind of confused by the sentiment that there has been posts about Charlie Kirk's shooting that are happy and gleeful. I won't deny that I haven't seen them. But there are also posts that are really angry about that and calling for war and violence against those people.
Yeah.
And Charlie Kirk himself has made
my reading of the mainstream media over the last few days, I would have said that the more incendiary, certainly higher up in the food chain of right-wing and left-wing politicians, the more incendiary stuff, I think everyone agrees, is coming from the right now.
That's my view as well. But it's also like, okay, but why is it that these things, these posts that some of us here find deplorable... Yeah. They're okay, but the posts that you find deplorable are not okay.
I find deplorable a post that revels in the slaughter of a young man.
And Charlie Kirk also made comments like that in his social media statements many times. Like, he called for the person who was... under arrest for the attack on Paul Pelosi. He was like, a good patriot should go and bail him out right now. Like, that's...
So you're saying that he did deserve it then?
I think all of this discourse is toxicity on both sides.
Would you not, you would accept that, wouldn't you? There's toxicity on both sides.
I do not believe, and I heard you talking to Leo Varadkar yesterday, and you both agreed that this would not have been, there would not have been anything like the same reaction had the person who was shot been a left-wing activist. That you would have had far more, you know, equivocation from the left.
I don't think there were actually gloating.
I mean, I think the reaction to it is one of the things that has struck me, because it illustrates, and I guess we're seeing it here as well, just how deeply divided America is, and the extent to which everything, whether it's a murder like this or the one in North Carolina that you referenced, or everything is seized upon as a point of difference. And there's been some, you know, people, I saw Bernie Sanders coming out, condemning this. But actually, those sort of reasonable voices have been completely drowned out by the extremes on both sides. And there's a piece in one of the papers, don't ask me which one it is, and today, and it talks about, there's some really good pieces in it. Katrina Perry's got a very good piece in the Sunday Indo about it. But there's one of the other pieces, I think it's in the Sunday Times, where it talks about, you know, the structure of the political structure of American society, and points out that actually the numbers of people on each side who are in that extreme space is a small minority. It's like less than 10% on each side. But because of the way political discourse has evolved and social media has a lot to answer for in this regard, those extremes completely dominate the conversation. I suspect that the number of people on the left who would justify the murder of Charlie Kirk are tiny. And I suspect that the number of people on the right who want to blame all liberals for this is pretty small as well. But the discourse there, the way they conduct their national political conversation, has become so toxified that everything just piles layer on layer up.
Scott, is Pat right? Are what we've been gorging on over the last few days, is it actually the views, a culture war being conducted by maybe 20% of America, and we have been viewing it as that this is a national conversation going on in America? Is it in fact like two extremes shouting at each other, except that one side happens to have the president in their camp?
That's exactly right. The vast majority of Americans, they certainly don't want to see a man killed in cold blood in Arizona, but they don't want to see mass shootings on a daily basis in the United States either. The vast majority of Americans would like an approach away from violence. But the issue that, like those on the outside, the so-called extremists don't, is that, for example, because of the way that politics work, to give you an example, there's no move towards gun control in the United States, which of course would be a leading cause of this violence. Secondly, there's an inequality because of the way that power is distributed, in which that some murders are held up for martyrdom, which is Charlie Kirk's, whereas, for example, when Michelle Hortman, who is the Minnesota legislator, was killed in cold blood this summer, there wasn't the moment of silence for her. Because I come back to this, although, Pat, they're on the right and on the left, the guy in the White House and his crew around him see an opportunity here. And the opportunity here is to drive an agenda in which they don't call for unity like the governor of Utah did. They don't call for people to take a step back. They redouble down on their war to, for example, as they're doing now, to purge government. You know that the order went out that anybody that criticized Kirk online is at the possibility of being fired. They are going out to purge.
When you say the order went out, no, it did. It's been self-appointed people. I know Laura Loomer is somewhere in there, and there are various people have set up these Twitter clearinghouses saying, report into us and we will.
Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, went online and said, you criticize Charlie Kirk, you could be fired. I mean, and he's online saying that. Justice Department said the same thing. But the broader thing here is what's being used is that Charlie Kirk's murder is a vindication to go after rights. It's a vindication to take certain individual cases, which are horrible, like the killing of the Ukrainian woman, and to ignore others, and to say, you have to go after transgender people, even though they less than 0.1 of 1% of mass shootings are by transgender people, by the way. It's to say you have to go after minorities, especially immigrants and refugees, because they could be dangerous. And you're going to see that rhetoric ramped up and up and up by Trump, by Steve Bannon, and by Stephen Miller, his key advisor. That's my real worry.
Okay. Brenda, what do you
think? I'm just coming back to this piece by Katie Balls where she's quoting an American historian, Victor David Hansen. He said, American can be a violent society. We don't usually murder major media figures. Now we do, and nobody knows what follows next. The demonization of people who disagree with you has reached a level that would have been incomprehensible in mainstream politics in the 1960s. And I mean, the depiction of somebody that you disagree with as a hater and their disagreement as hatred is what fuels this. And that is coming from both sides. And I mean, I don't know what Scott's been looking at, but certainly I have seen appalling posts, including by some Irish academics, all saying much along the same lines. Yeah, it was terrible. But, and I do think that that is an equally reprehensible decline in public discourse.
Okay, I'd go back to, I think that we'd have to agree that it is okay to have a fair assessment of who Charlie Kirk was and what he was about right now as well. I know we speak well of the dead, but I think if people are respectful of him and his family and everything else, that the politics are important to this, and his own family have politicised his death also. Scott, can I ask you, is there... you know, there's been talk in the last few days, people talking about that the mentions of civil war have gone up, that people talking, you know, we saw Charlie Kirk's widow talk about a battle cry going out. Are you concerned now that this leads to something else, or where does it go?
This is the most dangerous point. Certainly, I think in my lifetime for American society.
Do you really think so?
I really think so, and I'll explain why. We went through the horrific period of the 60s and the 70s with assassination of leaders. The Kennedys, Martin Luther King, for example, the attempted assassinations of other presidents and so on in the 1970s. But during that horrible time, including Watergate, including Vietnam, there still was a belief, as flawed as they were in American institutions, there still was a notion that we could have a consensus, that we could have a dialogue rather than division. That's what I grew up with. Even in the Reagan period, as divisive as that could be at some point, you still had that idea that he was a president for consensus. This is an executive which, because of the nature of the men in the White House and those around him, they don't believe in consensus. They don't believe that everybody comes together and finds a common ground. They wage this as a war, and they've used that term war before Charlie Kirk's murder. And my fear is that those vast majority of Americans in the middle who just want a decent, safe life, who want rights, who want justice, they're going to be overrun by the exploitation of what is a very damaged media culture, first and foremost, by those around Donald Trump.
Okay. And in unrelated but related news, I see the mayor of Memphis on TV last night saying that he found out on Fox News when Donald Trump said it, that the National Guard is being sent into Memphis to help with crime there. Elaine, two things I want to ask you. You want to talk about Julian Maloney's piece, which is about the impact of seeing this kind of stuff. Just before that, on what Scott and Brenda have been saying, again, you've probably seen more of these online culture wars or been through them than I think we're all seeing a lot of this one, but these things do go on. Is this different as an online culture war? Does it seem more toxic? Does it seem more dangerous? Or
it seems like a progression of what's been happening for a long time, because online discourse has always kind of touched the edges of the extreme and saying things behind a screen that you probably wouldn't feel comfortable saying if you were at a podium in a public space or something like that. And also there's an added layer of anonymity sometimes as well. So you have that factor. But also with the MAGA movement now in the White House and everything, and actually staffed with people who seem to have adopted the language of these kind of subcultures on the internet, and that has been helpful in courting people into that movement and ingratiating themselves with, say, a certain generation that are very online. Like you actually see even like the White House's own.
So you're saying that while these might,
culture.
Yeah, these might have been harmless extremes before, but now now one side in this.
Yeah,
has,
like I wouldn't even call them
now.
Harmless. I would just say that they're
Less potent.
The things that were happening and the people that they were hurting probably were only being covered by the tech press, like things like Gamergate, which is going years back. I mean, these were all precedents to where we find ourselves today as these movements have grown bigger and more powerful in that. People who are involved in those movements are probably staffers in the White House today.
Okay. Julie Maloney's piece then in the Sunday Independent, seeing videos of brutality does harm us, but not in the way most think.
Yeah, so she spoke to Brendan Kelly, professor of psychiatry at TCD and also a former Facebook moderator about the impact that seeing videos of violence can have on people. And I just thought it was an interesting perspective on the stories that are circulating at the moment because these videos of Charlie Kirk and of Irina Zarudska were circulating online. Kind of like we've seen the pullback on content moderation online. Things are very video led now, so platforms prioritize video. They autoplay them. So even if you're not trying to see this content, you are probably going to come across it, which is quite traumatizing for people to see a live murder happening in front of your very eyes when you're just logged on to hopefully see some cat videos or something like that. And what's interesting is like a lot of people feel that that can probably lead to like a desensitization towards violence for people. And Brendan Kelly's opinion is that the research doesn't back that up. But what it does do is actually kind of increases your sense of stress. It can lead to increased anxiety and depression because of the exposure to this kind of content. I mean, you think of even like the news of the world today as well. We are seeing violent content and harrowing images quite a lot. And it kind of actually affects you physically. You feel from watching those videos, even though you're at a remove from that place and time and that environment, you might feel that you're in a moment of threat and feel protective.
Okay. Now, look, I'm conscious that we were talking about people at different ends of things having a civility of debate there. And I appreciate that everybody with all the varying opinions around the table there kept that civil. And isn't it a great thing that we are still able to do that and that then we can move on and take a break and we will discuss something else with equal vehemence in a minute. So Pat Leahy, Elaine Burke, Scott Lucas and Brenda Power staying with us. Welcome back, Pat Leahy, Elaine Burke, Scott Lucas and Brenda Power still with us. Brenda, there have been a number of pieces and indeed an ongoing conversation over the last week about threats to Irish politicians. Yeah. And Ali Bracken in the Sunday Independent today. And now these are all these people have all want to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. But she has spoken to over 30 politicians who have various levels of threat made to them. The headline is, "You're lucky this time." Just tell us, some of the examples are extraordinary, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the context, obviously, of the serious and sustained threats that have been reported by Simon Harris and his family in the last week or so. But more than 30 politicians have received serious threats against them. They found 33 of the Sunday Independent, Ali Bracken, contacted I think all 174 members, and they found 74 TDs and 60 senators. 33 had received a serious threat. One minister living outside Dublin has been issued with several recent death threats. They said they have taken steps to enhance security in their home and their family been left terrified. One chilling text received while out for a walk named their exact location and told them, "You're lucky we didn't get you this time." This politician has also been the victim of a poster smear campaign in their hometown where they've been accused of facilitating rape and murder amid calls for them to be hung by their ankles in the town square. Another minister outlined threats involving two of their children, both aged under the age of six. One of their daughters was lunged at in the street and the man's words were aimed at the minister, but his physical aggression was aimed at my unsuspecting child. In another instance, the minister was carrying another daughter and just got out of their car when a man made an aggressive approach. He started screaming racist obscenities and anti-migrant vitriol, leaving the young girl in terror. A third minister was targeted in a sinister incident where they opened a letter and powder spilled out. Amid anthrax fears, specialist Gardaí were called in. It turned out to be harmless, but the fear was instilled. The same minister received a death threat saying they would receive a bullet to the head if they didn't implement specific political changes in a letter that included their home address.
Okay.
A fourth minister explained several death threats to Gardaí as well as abuse of his child online.
Okay, and your reflections on that?
So obviously this is, I mean, I read today, Brendan, that some of the traitors are getting threats. I mean, I think you read out the headline there that one of the traitors in a game.
Yeah, and I think she's not the first who's been
in a game. She's had to block people making toxic comments and calling her a witch, among other things. I mean, clearly this is outrageous. It is despicable. I don't know, other than compel the social media platforms to give up the names of these people and to require, you know, the fact that people are allowed to be anonymous in contributing on these platforms cannot go on. It can't be allowed to go on. You have to be able to identify people behind these threats. I mean, politicians, people who go on game shows, people who write columns have the courage to put their names to their opinions. This should not be the case that these people can intimidate and threaten behind the shield of anonymity.
Do you get this kind of stuff?
Yeah, we all do. Everybody does. You know, you do too.
Pat, the fact that there are so many stories appearing, and your own paper had a very good piece last week as well. Do I take it from that this is a very live and kind of alive discussion among politicians now?
Yeah, yes, it is. Anybody who works in politics or around politics, as I do, has known about this for a long time. Politicians haven't talked much about it. That was one of the things that Simon Harris referenced when he came out publicly last weekend. He says, you know, you're not supposed to come out and talk about this, but it's really serious. And he wanted to talk about it. And he did again at his thinking during the week. So this is a daily reality for an awful lot of politicians, and there is a sense amongst a lot of politicians that the guards are not taking it seriously enough, and they want the guards to be more energetic, I suppose, in following up this stuff. And to echo absolutely what Brenda is saying, the way to dissuade people from behaving like this is to track down who they are, to force the social media companies to reveal who they are, which they can do if they wish. They tend not to do it because it's not in their business interests to do it, but to force the social media companies to identify who the people who make threats are and to prosecute them. It is against the law as it stands to make threats of violence against people. So these people are breaking the law and they're being allowed to get away with it.
So a lot of the reason they're talking about it a bit more is that they want the guards to take it more seriously.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Elaine, is it possible to get to actually get the social media companies to play ball on this? You're making a doubtful face there, just for people who can't see you.
I think if you open that door, you don't just open it to people who want to follow up people who are like making threats online. You open that door to uncovering the identities of people who have a right to that privacy online. So you have to understand
that.
Not
necessarily. No, the guards can say we are investigating threats of violence against
people who break the law.
And in those circumstances, the social media companies can be forced for the specific purpose of a criminal investigation. That's a different thing too.
Is that going to be workable, Elaine? You still look doubtful.
Yeah, well, for the same reason I just said, like you open up backdoors to unveil people's identity, and those backdoors aren't only used by the authorities that you want to use them. That's kind of like a known cybersecurity issue, and that's cybersecurity experts' opinions on things like these. So I think that makes it difficult, but I do think
there might be a tipping point on the common good at some stage.
Yeah, again, people who campaign for privacy rights and civil liberties and stuff like that would say that it doesn't actually outweigh it. Okay. But I would also say, like, I mean, first step before you even go that far would be better content moderation on platforms, which they are completely getting it out on, have continuously had an out on for a very long time when you're talking about
and
platforms.
And have been scaling back, if anything, have they?
Scaling back, and already the scale wasn't really adding up. When you're talking about platforms of billions of users with content moderation teams that measure in the thousands, it's just not sufficient.
Okay, but we know Scott that they're not interested in moderating content. Yeah. It's not in their interests to do so.
Pat, you want to come in, or Scott, you want to come in briefly on that, because I do.
Facebook stopped moderation a few years ago. When Elon Musk took over Twitter, he effectively scrapped moderation, reinstated some of the accounts that were posting hate speech. But to give you the scale of the difficulty very briefly, part of this is that you have certain interests that will move against any type of attempt to moderate or limit, such as the backlash against the Online Safety Act in the UK. And part of the problem is that the person who is in charge of what is now called X was someone who actually whipped up people arguably,
okay.
with his call for certain Labour politicians in the UK to be
And I know that Brenda and Pat, as newspaper people, you're sitting there with your heads in your hands, knowing the amount of checks that anything you try and say goes through, still in much depleted newspapers, but the amount of money that's spent on legaling, checking, everything
and,
else.
And settling.
And settling. Okay,
responsible
listen.
For what we publish.
Yeah. The president, they're not publishers, Pat. Do you know, they're not publishers.
Well, they are.
Their line is they're not. Pat, will you kick us off on the presidency? And while being fair to all parties, will you tell us about Heather Humphrey's husband and the Orange Order? And you were at the launch yesterday.
Yeah. So Heather Humphrey's launched her campaign in Monaghan yesterday. There was a press conference after that. The fruits of some of the questions asked by the Mail on Sunday are on the front page of that today. And in what is, I'd say, a somewhat breathless account of a day that I didn't quite see the same drama in it myself. But it's revealed that Heather Humphrey's husband has, to quote the Mail, a secret Orange Order past. And so it turns out that Heather Humphrey's husband, Eric, was a member of the Orange Order, but Fine Gael clarified later after a number of questions by the Mail, it clarified that he had not been a member for almost 50 years, and this was before he ever met.
I know, but
Heather,
I think initially there was a suggestion that he wasn't a member, and like now, let's be fair to the Mail, maybe it's a breathless account, but given what we were just talking about, they spent the day checking. And they followed up on everything. Heather Humphrey's husband did seem to, according to them, duck into a unisex toilet. I don't know why that's important when they tried to ask him.
Yes.
Not a great look, Brenda?
No, not a great look. I mean, the point is, you know, she could well have responded to this by saying, yes, you know, and that is further... I suppose enhances my credentials for my claim to be able to reach across community as a president. Saying you better ask my husband is not the right response. And I mean, I think, you know, as always, it is the way you deal with these issues rather than what the actual answer turns out to be that can be very damaging. And it is astonishing that nobody in Fine Gael anticipated this question. And also, John Lee is saying that he attended an Orange parade in Drum in County Monaghan in 2014. She was apparently expected to attend there. They said she attended most years and said, we hope she'll be here tonight. She may be too busy in her new job. But they said subsequently she didn't, but that she had attended them in the past when her diary allowed. This is more recent, apparently, than she had indicated. She said she had only attended them as a child.
Yeah, and many Orange marches are not, well, it depends on where you're standing, but they are not sinister events.
No. I mean, I think there's a bit of so what about this, honest. And this was very much part of the theme that Heather Humphreys wanted to convey yesterday, was that, you know, as I suppose following the Mary McAleese bridge building theme, she was talking about how she, as an Ulster Protestant, would be ideally placed to reach out to people.
So then why didn't she say yes, he was?
In the North.
Look, these are the kind of things that can trip people up, and these kind of moments cannot be great. We'd agree. Okay, Elaine, I'm interested in your engagement so far with the presidential campaign. You're looking at Gary Murphy in the Sunday Times, Jim Gavin as a presidential gamble for the Taoiseach, but maybe not to focus too much on him, but your general views are there are three candidates so far.
Excited? Excited? No, not necessarily. I think like it is all just really kicking off now that we actually have a race going on. We have a number of candidates as opposed to just one person who has ended up for it. So, and for me with Jim Gavin, even though I'm a Dubliner, I actually didn't really know a whole lot about him. I'm not a big GAA fan.
Do you feel you do now after the
No, week? And that's the thing. I read that piece thinking, oh, I might learn something about him here, but the piece was really saying that we still don't really know much about Jim Gavin and where he stands on certain things. He also had his own media flub with like talking about Israel's military objectives in Gaza. Not the best kind of phrasing. And I do think, again, these are the kind of things where in the moment he slipped up in his phrasing, and that's the kind of thing that's going to be dissected. And from what I've seen of his media engagements, he doesn't seem to be well prepared for it. Like, he certainly certainly has
doesn't
had
have the same experience.
He
as
has certainly
the
had media training. I can kind of see the media training, but that means I can kind of see the strings. I can kind of see, like, just repeat these talking points as they are and just keep bringing it back to this. And it's not coming across as very coherent.
And of course, authenticity is very important to your to all generations at this stage, I think. Pat, you were writing yesterday about Sinn Féin's dilemma at the moment. Very interesting piece.
Well, thank you, Brendan.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah,
I mean, we're looking at the polls, and there's a poll in the Business Post today about the presidential election. But of course, the big missing piece in the presidential election, and this will be a big week for candidates. We know independent candidates.
So we have several councils happening tomorrow.
Tomorrow
and
Tuesday.
So
yeah, it's a bit of a Super Monday.
Councils so far,
tomorrow.
Though, not really minded to back anyone.
There's no sign that they will so far. I've always been sceptical that any of the three big parties are going to facilitate their rivals by letting them into the contest. Now, my colleague, Harry McGee, who's been on the council beat and has gone to see some of them, he's kind of convinced that, and I'm loath to contradict his judgment, he's convinced that one or two candidates will get in through the council route. And it is certainly the case, and I think we'll see this tomorrow, that the councils themselves will take, and the councillors will take this responsibility, this weighty responsibility.
They'll
take it quite seriously. And
they?
I think they'll be ready for the attention that comes with that. Whether that translates into letting more people into the race against the interest of the parties that they belong to, I remain to be convinced. But I think we will learn a lot more about their attitudes tomorrow and on Tuesday.
Okay, so Sinn Féin and also Catherine Connolly, who is a related story to Sinn Féin at the moment as to whether they decide to weigh in behind her.
For sure,
How is it going for both of them?
Well, I mean, we have Mary Lou McDonald at her party's thinking. I was writing about this yesterday, as you say, ruling herself out. She framed it very much as a personal choice of hers. And there was, we know, within the party, there were strong views. Many of them seems to be from Northern Sinn Féin that she should have run, which is, I thought. Now, she very clearly rejected that herself personally as a personal choice last week. There wasn't so much talk about the decision of the collective leadership of Sinn Féin, which is what one normally hears about these type of major strategic moves. And they still remain kind of at sixes and sevens. They don't know if they're going to run their own candidate. They don't know, if so, they don't know who it's going to be. Or maybe they back Catherine Connolly, which, you know, could be transformative for her campaign. All of this is very unlike the sort of careful, deliberate strategy that one normally sees from Sinn Féin. And my own view is that it bespeaks a sort of wider uncertainty in the party about its strategic direction in the wake of last year's electoral reverses. And the overall question about the party is, you know, how does it face the future? Does it just keep bashing away as it did for the last two electoral cycles and hope that it'll reach a breakthrough at the next election, or does it try and do something different? And in a way, it would be unusual if Sinn Féin wasn't questioning its strategy and its leadership after the elections last year. But I think this is just one visible part of it.
Would you be surprised if they backed Catherine Connolly, or would you be surprised if they didn't?
I think it would be unlike Sinn Féin to support a candidate that the party, you know, can't control itself. Having said that, it's difficult to see any of the candidates that it might run, that it might, you know, say, outscore the party's opinion poll rating, which might be some measure of success.
Okay, delicately put, Brenda.
I just listening to that interview with Mary Lou McDonald earlier in the week, I thought she did sound as though she was leaning towards supporting Catherine Connolly. She just talked about, she was referring to it as Catherine, and we will be meeting with Catherine, we'll hear what she has to say. I wouldn't be surprised if they did.
In the interest of the broader left alliance, maybe, and with an eye to the future. Okay, we'll take a break. Pat Leahy, Elaine Burke, Scott Lucas and Brenda Power staying with us. Okay, welcome back. Our panel still with us. Pat Leahy, Elaine Burke, Scott Lucas and Brenda Power. So Scott, this weekend, Belarus and Russia are playing war games on one side of the NATO's border with the East Russia, etc. On the Polish side, they have sealed the border, I think, and have troops lined up there. And people will remember that the last time these war games were played, this particular exercise that Russia and Belarus do, it was used as cover to move tanks in, to move equipment in to take over, attempt to take over Ukraine. Are we at, as was it Donald Tusk said, as close to war in Europe as we've been since 1945?
I'm not going to the bunkers just yet.
Okay.
Russia and Belarus, before 2022, had these exercises on an annual basis. So you can read in, they're just going back to resume them. I think the far more serious incident, which I think is a Russia testing of NATO beyond Ukraine, was sending the drones into Polish airspace. 21 drones coming in from Ukraine, from Belarus. You know, would there be air defenses against them? Now, at the end of the day, Poland and significantly NATO members did work together, knocked out almost all of those drones. At least 17 of them have been recovered. There was very little damage. I think there was a probe effectively by Russia at a time when Europe and Ukraine are discussing with the U.S. the whole question not only of Ukrainian security and European security. And I think, as with many of Vladimir Putin's gambles, I think this one has backfired.
And NATO now has also set up a sentry operation along the NATO border with the Russian sphere.
Yeah, it's called Eastern Sentry, because the threat from Putin is not as much a direct military invasion. It's what we would call hybrid warfare. So you have like these drone incursions, but you also have cyber warfare. You also have disinformation, propaganda operations, maritime operations. And NATO's done this for years. The question is, would they step up? I think in particular...
And you think Putin did get his answer and it was strong enough?
Yeah, I think it's strong enough to start with. I think we see what the further developments are. First of all, how much will Poland's defenses be reinforced? And those are the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Secondly, what are we going to see in the discussions on security guarantees for Ukraine, which will involve the U.S.? And thirdly, Donald Trump, who has swung like a weather vane on this, will he support toughened sanctions on Russia and its trading partners? His position now is, I'll support them if Europe goes first.
And if Europe stops buying oil from Russia as well.
Which it plans to do by the end of 2027.
Thing. Yeah. Okay. So you're calm at the moment.
Well, no one's ever calm, because the fact is that, that there will be the drone and missile attacks on the Ukrainian civilians day in, day out. But there's two points here. First of all, Russia's making very little defense on the military front line. Secondly, just the Ukrainian resilience in the face of these drone and missile strikes. And the more Putin pushes, the more he risks isolating himself, not just with Europe stepping up its support of Ukraine.
But that Trump is forced to actually involve himself a bit more. Okay. Elaine, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent. The author, Colin McCann, I think he wrote his book, A Paragon, about these two men. Tell me about this piece, We Need to Speak Up Like Our Lives Depend on It, because they do.
Yeah, this is basically to promote an appearance that Rami Elhanan and Bassam Aramin will be doing across Ireland. They're going to be in Dublin, Derry, Limerick, Galway and Mayo in October. And they are both fathers of people who were killed in the Israel-Palestine conflict, as in not just in the recent years, the very long-running conflicts there. And they, you know, present themselves as a sign that peace between these two are possible. And there's some just really powerful words in this piece from Rami, who is an Israeli and a Jew. And he says, from the day that his daughter was blown up in a Jerusalem market, I have fought every moment against the occupation, not just the physical occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, but the occupation of our hearts and our minds by a system that is poisoned with death, greed and cruelty. And he also mentions that, like, that greed element, like, fear makes money, fear creates divides. This war, this vulgarity, this genocide has become a kind of reality TV show for the world to see. The audience sits in the stands and cheers for its favourite team in a competition of pain. And I just think it's a really powerful piece from two people who are really right at the centre of what's happening there. And this event, as you said, from Colin McCann, it's also going to feature musician Colin McInimera. And I just think its voice is worth hearing here.
Okay. And a way of stepping back maybe from, what we're seeing on the screens all the time.
Yeah, and I think they're coming here as well because they've recognised Ireland's position on this, and they kind of see Ireland as a safe space to bring this conversation.
Okay. Listen, by the way, Pat, where are all the budget cuts today? I would have thought, are we not in that period?
Yeah, but so much of the political oxygen has been taken up by the presidential election. I was talking to somebody from the Department of Finance about this precise point recently, and they're loving it, of course, because they're managing to get on with things without budget kites flying several days a week.
The budget is rattled by all the electricity and gas price hikes during the week that this is going to ramp up pressure for them to find something down the back of the coach and give people something.
The problem is, I mean, there will be a budget package of whatever it is, $7.5 billion in current spending. That won't be as big as recent years, and it will feel an awful lot smaller because government repeatedly tells us that there's going to be no return of the one-off giveaways.
Are they going to hold the line hard on that right up to the budget, do you think?
They'll certainly hold the line up to the budget. my
will this
sense
be last minute late look, night kind of,
yeah. Political problems. This is a government that whose exchequer is awash with cash. The budget will show political problems. The Dáil is back this week. You'll see the government hammered on the cost of living every day that it's sitting. I think, you know, we should take the government at their word up until the point that it delivers the budget. Will there be some cost of living things in the budget? Yes, probably won't be one-offs, but there will be some giveaways, but it won't feel anything like last year.
Okay, but you've said giveaways. That'll be enough for people. Brenda, we have a couple of minutes left. Just tell us about Keir Starmer's troubles and a strong Irish angle on this.
Yes, because of course his advisor, Morgan McSweeney, is a Cork man. And the Mail is reporting today that at a discussion of the debacle of Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the US and the fact that he had to be sacked following very, very compromising emails and exchanges with Jeffrey Epstein, that Keir Starmer said to Morgan at a very explosive meeting yesterday, "You were supposed to protect me from things like this," and that it looks as though Mr. McSweeney is the one who is going to, if anybody's going to have to fall on their sword over this, that it is likely to be him, that he very much pushed for Mandelson to get this job.
Mandelson was his mentor.
Political mentor and close friends, and that there was a sort of a dossier drawn up when he was being considered for this post, and that it did highlight some concerns about him, including the Epstein contacts, but that it was sexed down, apparently. That is, I've never heard that phrase before, the opposite. A number 10 source denies that the advice was sexed down, and that exchanges between Starmer and McSweeney had been fabricated. This didn't happen at all. But that clearly the legitimate concerns that were there weren't adequately highlighted, you can put it like that.
Yeah.
He is going to take the blame.
People seem to think the one thing that might go in Morgan McSweeney's in favour in terms of keeping his job is that if Keir Starmer throws him to the wolves, as he has thrown others to the wolves, Keir Starmer's next. So maybe Morgan McSweeney gets to stay
he
there.
He might get to hang on a little bit longer.
Yeah. Elaine, we've about 30 seconds left. This is the kind of thing that can drive people potty. Ken Fox is a story across all the papers. There's those who say that Michael O'Leary should be running the country, and then those who complain about the Ryanization of everything. Health chiefs visited Ryanair HQ to learn how to cut waiting lists.
Yeah, it definitely is going to incense people, this idea that the Ryanair will be inspiring the HSE on efficiency. But essentially, senior management from HSE visited Ryanair HQ to learn things about how they dispatch their aircraft through like morning rush hour periods, essentially, to try and see how learnings from that might be applied to waiting lists and overcrowding in hospitals. There are learnings to be had here, but it will strike fear in people, the idea that
Ryanair's central point seems to be is that if you get the morning rush off, all right, the rest of the day will look after itself. too small land of Hibra, as they say. Okay, thanks very much to my excellent panel this morning, Pat Leahy, Elaine Burke, Scott Lucas and Brenda Power.